side will the dew of our life fall. At this very minute, this body is not my own. Life, which is controlled by time, never ceases even for an instant. Youth vanishes forever once it is gone. It is impossible to bring back the past when one suddenly comes face to face with changeableness, and it is impossible to look for assistance from kings, statesmen, relatives, servants, wife, or children, let alone wealth and treasure. The kingdom of death must be entered by oneself alone, with nothing for company but our own good and bad karma. Changeableness offers no permanent succor. I'm sure you've heard people saying, oh, well, when I've left school, things will be different. When I get older, things will be different. When I get married, things will be different. If I graduate, things will be different. And every time there is a change in the circumstances of the person concerned, yes, one problem seems to be relieved, but others appear. This is what Dogen is talking about here. People who rely on externals to give them relief. The danger of thinking that external change will be the permanent answer to one's situation is another cause of getting people to come to religion. Why do I go? Maybe things will be better. Maybe if I do this, maybe if I change my job, maybe if I go up to the monastery, the maybe if I do something, things will change. But that sort of changeability offers nothing permanent. It never can. The only permanent place, the only permanent state, is that which one finds in meditation with the unborn, the undying, and the uncreated. If you try to get it from any other place, it will always have some form of karma attached to it, either kusala or akusala karma, good or bad. It will always have disadvantages. I have heard people say how wonderful it would be if I were a stork or something, and all I'd have to do is wander around in marshes all day, and I wouldn't have a boss to bother me. Yes, but you'd have the predators. You have all sorts of things that will bother you. Every single creature has karma. And to change your shape or your position or your circumstances only gives you a totally different set of karma. I have heard monks in Shasta say, oh, it will be so wonderful to be a Roshi, then I will be able to do this or I will be able to do that. Yes, and you would also be on call 24 hours out of 24 for every kook and his friend who got into trouble. Forgive me for putting it that way, but I am quite serious, and I'm not referring to anyone here. We were talking to Reverend Hagan and I, but there is never a day when somebody does not ring up or come in through the door who does not need help or who is not mentally ill or who does not need something or other. So no matter what situation you are in, you are going to have karma. And changeability is not going to do anything about that. The only permanent place is to be found within the unborn, the undying, on the uncreated. Now, if you go to the next page, I think I warned you about the importance of avoiding those who do not understand the way in which karma works. This is one other bit on the same page. And that is simply because if a person does not fully understand karma, he will very soon get you embroiled in what can best be described as soap opera or emotionalism. Life is not really a simple matter. It is extraordinarily serious and extraordinarily hard work if it is lived properly. Because if you accept what you have done, if you accept karma as what karma is, the law of cause and effect, life can be very, very hard indeed. especially if you do not fully understand it. If someone comes to you and says, well, if I were to do such and such, then it would be all right. Or if I marry such and such, it will be all right. You know it's not going to be. You know there will always be problems. There is an old Chinese proverb of someone who came to a Chinese master and said, write me something to engrave upon my ring that will be of use throughout my entire life. And the old master said, write the words, it will pass. Whether it is pleasant, whether it is horrible, it will all pass. But you see, the place wherein you live, where it all passes, is within the meditative state, within the cosmic Buddha. Because only there does that which passes not bother you or cause you problems. Now, suppose you want to do something about your karma, you need to look at page 156. Because of their limitless compassion, the Buddhas and patriarchs have flung wide the gates of compassion to both gods and men. And although karmic consequence for evil acts is inevitable at some time during the three periods, that is past, present, and future, and remember that it doesn't necessarily have to be the next life, it can be the life after the next life, which is why so often really good people seem to have something come in and hit them out of left field, as I said last week. Although karmic consequence for evil acts is inevitable at some time during these three periods, contrition makes it easier to bear by bringing freedom and immaculacy. As this is so, let us be utterly contrite before the Buddhas. Now, the word contrite is not quite accurate, but I don't know of any other word that I can really use. It is a willingness to recognize that you have done something you shouldn't have done, a willingness to admit not only to others but to yourself that you've actually done it, and a determination to not do it again. Now, this brings us to something that Dogen Zenji, spoke of with very great vigor to several of his monks who were wondering about how one could escape from karma. And of course, one can't, as I have said. And the person was asking some rather useless questions in the real religious sense, but useful from the point of view of people who are trying to understand what is going on. And his question was, are acts, evil acts, of themselves intrinsically evil? And Dogen's answer was, before one is truly converted, i.e. before one knows truly what evil is, evil acts only have evil forms. But once one has really found out what evil is, then evil acts become something very, very different and much more dangerous. Supposing a person does not know the full meaning of the precepts of the Buddhas and patriarchs, ceasing from evil, do only good, and doing good for others, sounding really good, but not being completely understood in all their details. And this is one of the reasons why I've asked you to read pages 33 to 48 in depth in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, because that is an in-depth study of what the precepts actually mean. Supposing you haven't done that, and you do acts which have unfortunate consequences, does this ruin you for all time for becoming one with the cosmic Buddha? And the answer is no. But supposing you really know that an act is absolutely wrong, and you willfully go ahead and do it, then, yes, you are going to really reap a terrible consequence. Karmically, you're going to have a very rough time indeed. And this shows even more so with people who have had some sort of a religious experience. For example, a person who has had a first kenjo, who then does an act which is, he knows is wrong, but does it anyway, whether it is in a fit of pique or a fit of temper. And people, you should know that Zen masters can create karma. I'm sure you know the old story of the one who said he couldn't and landed up several thousand lives as a fox. The Zen master is just as much bound by karma as is everybody else, because otherwise he would be God, and he is not God. He knows that he is not God. Therefore, since the Zen master or the person who has had a first kenjo can create karma, it is very, very important that he shall not create any more. But if he actually does, then the consequences of that act are going to be quite incredible. They are going to be much more serious than if he had created it prior to knowing that it, prior to knowing that it was actually really wrong. I can give you an example in my own life, without giving you much in the way of details, in that I had had a first fairly large kenjo in Japan, and I then, as a result of various idiocies with my family, set something else going again, and the consequences are still going on. I didn't need to do it, so I got in a temper, so I did it. That is to make an excuse. It is not to sit up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and patriarchs and say, yes, I did it, I wish I hadn't. But the consequences are what are happening right now. I knew it was wrong to do it, and I went ahead. So it's easy to say, well, I was in a temper at the time. I still knew it was wrong. The consequence for evil acts after one knows that it is wrong to commit them is much graver than before. This is why I suspect, but I have no proof of this, this is why a first confession made in the Catholic Church frequently brings such incredibly deep, an incredibly deep feeling of peace to a person. I have often talked to people who are ex-Catholics who said, well, that first confession I went to was marvelous. I came away feeling so clean and incredibly good. And now when I go, I'm just all jaded. And it doesn't sort of have the same effect. Yes, because the first time you genuinely cleaned it up. And the next time you did the same thing again. And it's not as simple, because the next time round you know you shouldn't be doing it. You cannot play games with God, or the cosmic Buddha, or XYZ, or whatever happens to be your particular liking and particular name for him. So, the importance of sitting up straight and facing what you have done, facing the consequences of what you have done, this is one of the most important things that you can possibly do if you would truly have some sort or any sort of religious experience. And it is not until you finally say no to doing evil that you will get any real religious experience. Again, I can give you an example from my own personal life. Every time I have had a kenjo, it has been when I've looked at something in me that I have been doing over the years and said, no, I won't do it again, and kept to it. I think I told you, I can't remember, maybe the first lecture we had, I think I told you that I discovered that I have been lying in a way on various government forms. Do you remember I told you about that? And one day I said, no, I won't do it again. I don't care whether the government throws me out or whether they like it or whether they love it. I am not going to allow someone else to force me to make a mistake. Now, prior to that, in the earlier days, I had made the mistakes. And now I was allowing other people to allow me to make the mistakes. And I was saying no on a deeper level. And it was that which triggered the next religious experience. In other words, if you are going to get rid of karma, you have really got to take hold of your life and say, no, I will not be placed in this position. I will not allow the world to put me in this position. I will do what I know to be absolutely right, irrespective of the consequences to me. And what I did could have had me, it could have got me thrown out of the country, because I effectively wrote to the Attorney General in Washington and said, look, I'm not going to play games with your government. Either you believe what I say and you let me do it the whole way truthfully, or I'm not going to go ahead. Fortunately, the Attorney General agreed with me. But he might not have done. So you've got to take it every inch of the way. And you also have to believe in the same way, just as you will not allow anyone else to allow you to make a mistake. And that's really what I'm talking about here. Not only will you not make a mistake, you will not allow someone else to make a mistake for you, and you will do everything you can to prevent another person making a mistake. You can't stop him, but you'll do everything you can to stop him. Not only do you do that, you also have to do this with faith. It is not good enough to just believe. You have to be in such a state when it is impossible that you could possibly think of the possibility of the possibility of even the slightest possibility of doubting. So you cannot even allow in a possibility of doubting. Do you understand why I'm going? Well, you remember I told you about the screw and how you're going down the screw? You're going further and further down it. It's not just enough to have faith. This is why so often when you have these revival meetings and people have faith, they have faith, it's so wonderful, and they feel that they have been converted, and then several weeks or several months later they wonder what it was that happened. Yeah, it works at the beginning. You've got the conversion, but unless you keep on going further and further into it, unless you work at it, and it is that which is the actual training, unless you work at it, then it's going to slide away. And all you will have left is a really exquisite memory. Nothing more. As Yasutani Roshi put it, all you have left is a beautiful dream. Don't find yourself left with a beautiful dream. You really have to work at this, and you really have to know, I hesitate to use the word, you have to know that there are levels of understanding, but I don't know what other word to use. If you like, you can say that the different goings around, the circuits around the screw are levels, but it's all one going. It's not separate rings. It is all one long going, a continuation of training. And just as you have taken charge of you and said, no, I won't lie anymore, then you've got to take charge of you and say, no, I will not allow others to lie around me, and I will ask them to point out to me when I am exaggerating something, or when I am actually lying, or when they think I am lying, and I'm not going to feel upset about it. And then you've got to take it to the further one, which is, and I am not going to allow them to place me in a position where I will lie. And you have to take it that far on every single one of the precepts. And that is what I'm trying to talk about in that part of the How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, 33 to 48. And this is why I want you to study this with such great care. And you see, in the end, if you study the precepts in that way, you discover that the only person, supposing somebody has been shoplifting or stealing or something of the sort, in the end you discover that the only person who is stolen from is yourself. And it is very scary when you get final stage of understanding what the precepts really are and how the only person who has really been hurt is you. Now, Buddhism for centuries has had a system whereby people can work on themselves to find out all of this and to discover that along with finding it out go certain physical and mental states which they can work on for themselves and in a way sort of ripen. Ripen's a good word for it. They can sort of ripen like fruit so that they become somewhat painful and cured. And that is what the second half of the Book of Life is about. How to ripen these various things. Now, before you can actually start that, though, you've got to sit up straight in the presence of the Buddhism patriarchs and your own conscience, which is the embryo of the Buddhism patriarchs, and say quite bluntly, all right, I'm going to look at me. I've done an awful lot of things. I'm going to take a good look at them. And the reason is, as it says here, here is the way in which to make an act of perfect contrition. May all the Buddhas and patriarchs who have become enlightened have compassion upon us, free us from the obstacle of suffering which we have inherited from our past existence, and lead us in such a way that we may share the merit that fills the universe. For they, in the past, were as we are now, and we will be as they in the future. The most important piece in that, they were as we are in the past. We will be as they in the future. It's not maybe I'll go to heaven or maybe I'll go to hell. It is, if you work on yourself, you will be as the Buddhas and patriarchs. It's not just a possibility, it's a certainty. Because they were as we are now, and we will be as they are in the future. And this is the thing that gets the will going to really do something about it. The certainty of where we are going to go. All the evil committed by me is caused by beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. All the evil is committed by our body, speech, and mind. I now confess everything wholeheartedly. Confess is not a good word. I will now take a good look at and do something about. How do you translate Sangha? I do not know. I just don't know how you translate Sangha successfully. It partakes of contrition, confession, doing something about it, grabbing your will, cleaning up the blood. But I think you get the general idea. By this act of contrition, we open the way for the Buddhas and patriarchs to help us naturally. Bearing this in mind, we should sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha and repeat the above act of contrition, thereby cutting the roots of our evil doing. Now, cutting the roots of your evil doing does not stop the consequence of the evil doing. It cuts any more. The consequence may continue. As Keizan points out very clearly in the Denkwaroku, there is one of the greater patriarchs of whom he is speaking there, and he adds, but although he is now this great patriarch, his old karma may still work upon him. There is a famous story of the Buddha who converted a thief, and the thief wanted to go and visit his family, and as he came near the village, the villagers started to stone him, and he said, first of all he got angry, and then he said, but I stole a lot of things here, this is the rightful consequence. And he went on, and they noticed his yellow robes, and they stopped stoning him, and he apologized to everyone and guaranteed to give everything back, and he was accepted as a great monk. Supposing he hadn't done that, he would never have had the courage of knowing that he could be completely and absolutely forgiven. Go ahead, yes.
Can you explain sitting up straight in
Too many times people run and hide from what they have done, and they hide from it within themselves. They cannot even admit to themselves. But to sit up straight and say, yes, I did it, to yourself, and then eventually to the rest of the world. That is sitting up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and patriarchs, admitting to yourself the Buddha within. Too many times we cannot just be willing to admit that we do various things because of the shame and the horror of it. But it's much worse not to do it. Page 29 in the Book of Life. Have you got it with you? At the bottom, you'll see there's a graph. So-called human state of sanity containing usual amount of instability, greed, hate, and delusion. The usual amount, you know, that people... We have a sort of a cut-off line as to where we say, how far we say a person can go. It's interesting that we use that terminology. I won't let him go any further than that, or I cannot stand it going any further than that. And what we are really saying is that we're not going to allow... We have a standard below or above which we normally do not act. We like the idea of going above it, but frequently we will not allow ourselves to go below it. During war and other insanities, we push the sanity line down a bit further than usual. Now, that sanity line is this area here, the area between the yellow and the purple. And above it, you have the areas of compassion, love, and wisdom. And below it, the three madness areas. That's taking it on the psychological level. Now, this represents both what we can do in our own lifetime and what does happen after death. This is the Lord of Conscience, who appears in many forms in various religions, and in Christianity as the Day of Judgment, etc., and in Buddhism as the Lord of Conscience or the King of Death, according to whether you are still alive or dead. Here you have brain, here memory, here akusala karma or bad karma, and here kusala karma or good karma. Over here you have the tunnel that you go through at the time of death, which, by the way, you also go through when you get a really big kensho started. Because you should know that when one has one of these really big religious experiences, you are also having a rebirth experience. Rebirth into a different plane of consciousness. Now these... This is the place of choice. You can either go along and argue with your conscience, or you can go straight up here, do a terrific sangha for everything you've done, in which case you do a sort of fairly quick... Well, you don't even go anywhere near this section. You do a tremendous sangha for what you have done by sitting up straight in the presence of both your own conscience and the Buddhas and patriarchs, in which case the rest of this is yours, or, and this is the one we are most used to, you start an argument and remorse stands one side. And these heads represent the good and evil nature of the person that is speaking, either owning up to what they have done or arguing about what they have done. Almost everybody, when he does a big kensho, has at least one or other past life come up in which he can see what he himself was truly like either in this life, earlier in this life, or in some past life. This is the great round mirror which is spoken of in the scriptures in the Hokyo Zammai, which we shall be studying later on, which tells you exactly how to do the type of meditation that will get you into this area. Now, supposing you're still arguing, but that isn't me, I can't be like that. I know I can't be like that. You're going to come down here. If instead you sit up straight and say, this one's sitting up straighter, by the way, than the other one is. If instead you sit up straight and say, my God, I did that, and I swear I won't do it again, then this is going to disappear because you have recognized what you truly are like. And this section of the story is going to be yours. Now, there are a lot of these that are extraordinarily applicable to everyday states. For example, here you have the mountain of needles. Now, if you do not accept a tremendous amount of the things you do, haven't you had that feeling of being pricked all over, you know? And there's nothing I can do about it, you know, you sort of wriggle because you're on the mountain of needles. This is Kanzeon, or the compassionate aspect of the Buddha, in her wrathful aspect. As you note, she is taking even the loincloths off of the dead that have come through, or off of the Buddha natures that have arrived, because she is removing the masks. If they won't believe the state they're in, then I'll tear the masks off them so that they really see. And it hurts all the more when compassion rips off the mask and you really see what's going on. Do you understand? The compassion removing the masks. These are the scoffers and the dissenters. They want religion, they think, but their throats are too small to swallow it, and their bellies are too big and empty to be able to get it in. They want food, they want spiritual food, but they can't make it. Every time they get near religion, it seems to turn red hot for them. No way can they get in. These are the people who do it by ascetic means. They are storming heaven. They're beating themselves up. The Valley of Spears. So often people feel they're being thrown on spears. This is wallowing in unfairness. This huge burden I have to carry. I have these burdens. There's no way in which I can make it to the cosmic Buddha. I have this to do and I have that to do and I'll never manage it. And the burden gets bigger and bigger, and as you look down, the fire is hotter and hotter. And then when you have done that, when you're fed up with it, this is worldly unfairness, then you fall down into the fire and you just wallow in the unfairness because you've still got the burden. This is the Buddhist explanation of hell, which we create in this life for ourselves. We do not have to be in this hell. We can choose to be in this heaven all the time during our lifetime. If we take the trouble not to be stuck with changeability, if we take the trouble to meditate and find out what really it is that is the real us, if we're only interested in external feeling, worrying about external things, we will always be below this sort of awful yellow smog. If we are interested in something else, in finding the truth, then this area is ours. Taking a look at a few more of these, this is a favorite one. Oh, consumption by bestiality, of which I do not need to make any explanations. Then there is wallowing in bestiality, or complacent bestiality, being comfortable with our bestial situation, which is a very nasty and dangerous place to be in. But this one most people know more than anything else. That is the narrow gorge of frustration. We're so frustrated, and we're being pushed through this gorge, squashed with everyone, and there is nothing we can do about it. But always in every one of these places there is something we can do about it. If we look, we can see a Buddha in every single place. That's if we want to look. I.e. any time you take the trouble to look inside you, you'll find the Buddha. Or you can go on being squashed. It's up to you which way you want to do it. This is the graphic explanation of karma. Now down here you get to the rather nastier state. There comes mild paranoia. What's going to happen to me? Somebody's going to do something to me. And then you get to paranoia, and then you get to wallowing in paranoia when you know there's no hope for you. Interestingly enough, the hill of frigidity comes quite low down. You get the woman sitting on top of the icy mountain and the man trying to come up to her. That comes quite low down in the hills. And then you get the hope of the suicides and the place of suicides. And you get the gateless gateway to the Buddhahood, and you get the cosmic Buddha. Now you note that here, the Buddha looks really ghastly. He looks like a monster that's about to devour you when you're in that state. But if you truly look and if you truly trust, you find that these monsters that are about to devour you are in fact the gateways in to your own true Buddha nature. So there is nothing that you must ever fear. Down here in the lowest hell of all, where people say, I can't stand it any longer, so I will destroy the Buddha that created me. I will kill myself. Down even in that place are the banners of the Buddhas to be seen. If you really turn and look. Now, almost everybody, I believe everybody in this room, can identify with some place or other here at some time or other during most days of the week. What they don't realize is that as a result of meditation, they can identify with the whole of this section every day of the week. Because we all know hell as a result of our karma, it does not seem to most people don't seem to realize that they may also know heaven. And the purpose of meditation, and I'm using these words relatively now, the purpose of meditation is to realize that you do not need to be in any of these states. And what is to be found in the second half of the Book of Life is how to deal with these specific states. Now, the Book of Life also tells you a lot of other things. For example, if you work on the mudras for frustration, you will also do quite a fair amount of work on helping your gallbladder to stay healthy. That's an accidental bonus. You do not work on the mudra in order to get a healthy gallbladder. You work on the mudra because you suffer from frustration a lot. By accident, the gallbladder becomes healthier. Despair, by working on the kidneys, you seem to open up the deepest of hells. You open up all the really deep fears, the deep frights, the deep terrors. You've come to face all the most ghastly things about yourself. That is the fear and despair ones. By accident, that also seems to help your kidneys, which also gets your dynamo going, which also gets you meditating properly. So all of these things, you are dovetailing body and mind together at all times. Don't ever think that this psychophysical body is of unimportance. That is one of the graver mistakes that most religions have made. This body is deeply important. By its ages, we are able to come to know the true owner thereof. We are able to come to know the true Buddha. We are able to find that place wherein lies the unborn, the undying, and the uncreated. And in so doing, we clean up a tremendous amount of physical sickness
and prevent a tremendous amount of physical sickness.
Above all, remember that this is a picture of what can happen in life. Not only do you escape from the hell that changeability will not enable you to escape from, you also find a bonus, which is the joy and peace of being in the other half of that picture. And you do not have to wait until you're dead to do it. Because, you see, if you wait until you're dead to do it, you haven't really got the time to clean up the karma. The only thing you can do is say, right, I'll take another life, and I'll try to do better next time. But who knows that you are going to definitely get a human life? How can you be sure it's not going to be an animal one? How can you be sure you are not going to make more mistakes? So often, I have found with people who have done this, they have had a past life come up in which they have done exactly the opposite to what they are doing now, because it's worried them so much what they had done in this previous life that they decided, right, next time round, I really won't do this, and they've gone all the way over to the opposite. But it is not the opposite that is necessarily wanted. It is the middle way between the two. And so they're just as badly off in one way as they were in the other. What proof have you of that? And it's just as one does not wish to stay in hell, it is also equally important to know that one should not wish to stay in heaven. It is just as dangerous to stay in heaven as it is to stay in hell. Because when the good karma has run out, then guess where you're going to be? Right back sitting looking at the Lord of Conscience again. That is why it is important to meditate early and find that place wherein lies genuine, complete, absolute certainty and peace. And that is not just in heaven, and it is not just in hell. It is a third place. You remember I said you have to get beyond the opposites? There is this third place, the unborn, the undying, the uncreated. That is the place to which you must get. Do not stay in heaven, and do not stay in hell under any circumstances. Yes, quite.
You always say you clean up bad karma. Do you clean up good karma too, in the same sense?
Yes. It's just cleaning it all up, all the way. And you see, if you're... Yeah, the reason I always do it this way is that everybody knows hell, but not very many seem to know heaven. But you do have to do both, you're right.
It's cleaning up in both stages.
Is that
the ideal to look for?
No. You have to go through the whole lot. But you see, there is one nice thing about it. If you cut all the akusala karma, if you cut all the bad karma, and you live solely from the center of your being, which if you live from the cosmic Buddha, and what you do thereafter is not bad karma, you do get heaven as a private bonus. But you didn't do it in order to get heaven, and heaven is not a permanent state. That's what I think you were talking about.
Yeah.
The fact that it is not a permanent state. Any more than hell is a permanent state.
Yeah.
You can make the hell deeper. You can make the heaven brighter. But they are both subject to changeability. Yeah. Now you can have one of these pictures. You can go through your various states. One of the ways in which I use it, go through your various states that you've been in the day. All right, what damage have I done to this particular organ or that particular organ, or what needs attention? Look it up, check it over in the Book of Life, do the necessary mudras on it, and get the necessary releases and be ready for the next day. But it is not just enough to do the mudras. You have to make the solemn determination, all right, so I got caught. tomorrow I'm not going to get caught the same way. It is not just enough not to be pleased with it. You've got to do something about it. Or in the end, the mudras don't have much effect because you're not serious about what you're doing. I have to watch it with my kidneys because they get fed up any time trainees don't do as well as they might, or somebody does something really stupid and my kidneys can't move. What the heck? Why bother? You know, which is a very mild form of despair, but nevertheless despair. So I have to watch that one coming up in me. Because within seconds it could become very serious. You cannot allow such things to happen. So you're always having to be aware of what is going on. Aware of what is going on at every minute. Go ahead.
You know, you talk about doing good, and I tell you, you know, no matter what you do, somebody is going to get hurt.
So I have to watch that one coming up in me. Because within seconds it could become very serious. You cannot allow such things to happen. So you're always having to be aware of what is going on. Aware of what is going on at every minute. Go ahead.
You know, you talk about doing good, and I tell you, you know, no matter what you do, somebody is going to get hurt.
Not necessarily. If they get hurt, it is because they have not trained themselves enough not to get hurt. You cannot be responsible for what somebody else does with his karma. You can do the very best you possibly can to make sure you don't create any more karma. Now, if somebody takes a good act and goes off and creates bad karma with it, there's nothing you can do about that. That's his headache, not yours. You are not responsible for the world.
Or a person is unhappy, too. Doesn't mean that.
Yeah. Don't play Atlas. That's a favorite game of monks. Playing Atlas is famous. Especially of new Zen masters. They come out looking incredibly holy. I can remember in Sojiji, oh, we got another one. And they would sort of throw him into the officer's training corps, as we call it. And you were so holy in your own mind, you were going to convert the entire world. And Dogen talks about it of himself when he was first out of China. And he says, I was as a man carrying a great burden. Now I've put it down and I seem to be doing rather better. It's nice to know that Dogen did it and Kazan did it. And every new Zen master I've ever known has done it.
And so you
should.
And that's what bothers me. Was it me or was it he?
Don't worry about it.
Was it the weather?
How badly do you feel about it when you've done it? Do you really feel badly about it?
It's me, yes.
But do you know it's you?
No. Sometimes. But so much of the time I don't. I guess
if you don't know it's you, the odds are that you're innocent. If you know it's you, you're dead certain you're guilty. Do not create guilt where guilt does not exist. You cannot be responsible for idiots.
I think I know what she's saying. I have a tendency to always think that I'm wrong.
So does every woman I've ever met with. It's the way we've been educated.
Right down the line, no matter what.
And you know, when I first went to the Far East, I had a... My koan was, I could be wrong, not my koan, my sort of mantra, if you like, was, I could be wrong. And it got me to a tremendous distance. But then there came a day when I said, okay, this is going to change, I could be right.
Yeah.
And sometime or other you have to make that decision and say, yes, I could be right. But we are, as women, frequently brainwashed into that,
yeah.
Certainly the older ones.
I seem
the younger
to
ones aren't so much.
It's wrong to think that I could be right.
No, it's wrong to think that you couldn't be right. Very wrong to think that you couldn't be right. Yes. And you should understand how rebirth works. in this connection. Now, on page 10, there's a very little piece about it in this, which is a nice little intro to the greater amount of it in the Book of Life. Past karma conditions the present birth, and present karma, in combination with past karma, conditions the future birth. As stated earlier, rebirth must be distinguished from reincarnation or transmigration, since no unchanging or eternal soul is non-existent. Since an unchanging or eternal soul is non-existent. Since there is no individual I to think, then there is nothing to be reborn. Now, it is the thinking of there is an individual I that causes the problem. Because it is the individual I that always gets the hurt. Did I do something? That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But the individual I, did you do things out of the individual I or out of the cosmic I? That's what the first chapter of the Denko Raku is about. Shakyamuni Buddha is born out of this I. In other words, he is reborn from the ego to the cosmic Buddha. The lord of the house is now the cosmic Buddha. It is not the ego. And if you can honestly answer that everything you have done concerning something is an attempt to cease from evil, an attempt to do only good, an attempt to do good for others, then you are doing it out of the cosmic Buddha and not out of the I. Don't get the two confused.
That attempt that brings a little relief.
Because it is an attempt. Yeah. One day you will...
It's all I can do half the time.
Yes.
It's an attempt, I can't always do it.
Now, one day, the deeper you go into meditation, you will know that what you are doing is out of the cosmic Buddha. And then comes a great danger, because that is the time you have to take the biggest refuge possible in your fellow monks. Because the certainty itself can be dangerous. You could then just slide right on past, straight into the egocentric eye again, and then start doing evil, thinking that it was good. So the Zen master, the higher he goes, the more he has to take refuge in the other Zen masters around him, for the safety of the rest of the disciples. And if he does not take refuge in the others, then he is in trouble. Because he is saying, virtually, I know I'm always right. And he is not always going to be right. But the very certainty is a danger.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Would you please explain what you mean by refuge in the other monks or Zen masters?
Supposing there is a nasty decision to be made or a difficult decision to be made, and everything in you says, well, it should be done in a certain way. Now, you could be doing it just because a little advantage will accrue to you, or you would like it to happen in a certain way. Or you may be doing it because it is the right way for it to happen. So what you do is you call in the other Zen masters and say, look, such and such is the decision. What is the best way to do it? Let us meditate on this and find out the will of the cosmic Buddha. And if you all come up with the same answer, then that's the right way to do it. But it may not be the answer that you yourself want, because you have got the ego just coming up again. The ego can always sprout again. The converted ego can always just very slightly sprout. So the higher you go, the more you have to watch it. Okay? That's what's meant by taking refuge in. Don't just take refuge in you. I know that I am right and everybody else is wrong. Because that's the road that leads to dictatorship. The higher you go, the more you have to get other people to be in with you to help.
What does a lay person take refuge in if they're not in the monastery? Or who?
Well, that's why they don't get recognized as Roshis. Even after they have had kinshoks. In other words, you remove the danger of doing harm.
Except I'm really serious.
I know you are.
What does a lay person do? You have to do something if there is this danger.
Well, the normal thing is to become a monk, or at least to become a layman who lives in a monastery and discusses with the monks. There isn't any other way out round or under it. There really isn't. Sojiji had a very interesting system. They had a special certificate for laymen who had made it, which was sort of almost like an ID card. They could come in and get information from any of the Roshis at any time. And it merely said, this person studied at such and such and such and such for so long, and did well. Which was virtually the equivalent of saying, let this one in, this one's going to need help, because they have not got the actual Sangha behind them. No, I have not seen one. That I don't know whether they still issue them, but they certainly did, I was told, right up until World War II. So that's how it's done. Maybe the day will have to come when we'll have lay people who've had kenshos, and we'll have to issue some sort of little card saying, let this one in. Does that help you? Does that answer your question? Yeah, it's not an easy situation to be in. Now, in the Book of Life, I think you'll find it's on page 5 and 6. Forgive me for running over a little, but I do want to try and get this done if I can today. There's a section that is very important. Forgive me for reading this, it's only 2 or 3 paragraphs. For centuries, the argument against rebirth has always been statistical, i.e., if a person dies, another must be born in his or her place. So why is the world population always changing? However, rebirth does not work this way. The physical body disintegrates and becomes recyclable material for use by the as yet unpurified karma-carrying sparks of spirit. These sparks become living organisms exactly in ratio to their own unpurified karma, and are thus again given a chance to transcend that karma by purification, thereafter returning directly to the Buddha mind, sometimes called the Buddha nature. Because of the above, it is impossible and even stupid to expect a baby human to be born every time another human dies. Anything can be born as a result of any death, whether human or animal, and because every being in the world has done totally different things from everybody else, there is no formula that can be laid down as to what will happen specifically to anyone. Only the individual can do something about that for himself through meditation. All that can be truly said is that certain acts will have adverse effects on new life, and other acts will have beneficial ones. The Buddhist precepts are the nearest a person can get to a working formula for this purpose. Nor is just one being likely to result from the death of a previous being. An unconverted carnal lust may be reborn in animal form. An unresolved confusion at the time of death may be reborn in a muddle-headed human, as a muddle-headed human, and a secret and hidden evil act may cause the birth of a fixed or wandering ghost. Just to give a few examples, thus the death of one human could result in the rebirth of an animal, a human, and a ghost, all out of the unpurified part of that human's karma, which will then become purified in its own way to become a beautiful part of the Buddha mind. Such unpurified karma becomes a karmic debt which the newborn creature inherits. Now, why I said that is because on this top half of the picture, you can see that after Sangha there is genuine rebirth. And at the moment of a real Sangha, one of the interesting things that happens during an actual Kensho experience is that there is a moment when all functions cease. One is as if completely dead. And then there is rebirth. Now, for some, it is genuinely pictorial. One sees most of it. Others just feel, others just know. But it genuinely takes place. Now, you can have a rebirth either just in heaven, or you can be content with it, or you can go on
and wish to become a true monk and be transmitted into it, or you can become a bodhisattva who comes back and works in the hells, or you can become an arahant and a possible future Buddha. There are a million things you can do. And the Buddhist explanation of people who seem to have split personalities, one minute completely holy and wonderful and beautiful to know, and the next minute doing something extraordinarily diabolically badly, is that somehow or other, somebody has had one of these experiences and not completely converted one or other of the 10 precepts. So there are moments when they seem to flash into hell. Now, one of my disciples is a psychologist who is working on this to see what he can come up with statistically and seeing how the mudras can help in this way to perhaps stop a lot of people who are in mental institutions from going to them in future, because there are alternative ways. I just add that in as a piece of interest. Okay, let's see what we've got in the way of questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Throughout the script,
yeah,
there is always often a choice.
Oh, yes.
The whole thing is choice. I mean,
yes.
Whatever Kanzai appears only offer.
If you want her to appear as awful.
Offering.
Yes.
The help, and it's
yes.
always the choice to turn away
yes.
or to.
I'm sure you have heard of. I'm sure it has happened to you that someone has offered to do something for you and you knew it was right, but you turned away from it and you hated the person for having offered it. That often happens. I have that situation frequently. I offer people teaching in certain ways. Supposing a person has come to me and said they really and truly want to be a priest. I say, all right, now, it's going to cost you this, that, and the other to do this. You're going to have to give up this, you're going to have to give up that. And the person says, well, do I really have to give up that particular thing? And I tell them, yes. And becoming a priest looks rather awful, and the cosmic Buddha looks slightly mean. But he's not. It is the person who came to the cosmic Buddha and asked for the thing, and asked to become the priest. If you walked into a shop and said, look, I want to buy that shirt, but I'm only willing to give you so much for it, the store manager will be quite right to say, I won't sell you the shirt. Too many people want to barter with God. But the price of becoming one with the cosmic Buddha is the price. And all I do, as someone who teaches, is simply to say, well, look, the price of doing this is such and such. And then they blame me because of the price. I'm sort of the Cosmic Buddha's store manager. What do I tell the Cosmic Buddha? You get what I'm saying?
Does he ever have sales?
I've never bumped into any. I have never bumped into any. This comes out most with people who say, well, I want to be a priest, but I've really got to be able to be married and have children. Now, you can have a first Kensho and be married and have children. There is no way you can have a third one. And I don't make the running. That's how it is. So I've sort of got a store window with this one costs so much, and this one costs so much, and this one costs so much. All right, how much do you want? Well, this lifetime I only want to buy the first one, all right. But know that that's what it is. Well, I'd really like the third. Well, I don't have an alternative to that. It would be nice if they didn't blame the store manager now and then. Yes, go ahead.
You said something about psychologists studying people
that
have kinchos or
something. What they're trying to do, this particular person, he is a monk, he'll be back with us in December, has often found people in mental institutions who he felt pretty certain had had kenshos, but, well, nobody knew what had happened to them. And you see, the beginning of a Kensho does look very like a psychotic break, except that there is no fear and no worry in it. I'm sure you've heard of Zen stories of when he had his Kensho, he laughed and rolled on the ground and kicked his feet in the air or cried his eyes out. What do you think that looked like to his friends and neighbours? Supposing, shall we say, Maisel over there were to suddenly roll on the ground and kick her feet in the air and yell and scream, what would you do? The average person would go out and he'd call the funny farm wagon. Because that's the only thing he would know to do. But you see, the Zen master will listen and say, right, is there terror in this? Where is this laughter coming from? Is it coming from a feeling of peace inside? Or is it coming from something else? I can remember when my third one stopped it. I turned up at the Berkeley Priory, walked in, collapsed into Daiso's arms, crying my eyes out, saying with a big grin on my face, don't worry, I'm doing fine. He sort of looked at me and said, you are? I said, yes, I'm fine, just don't worry about it. Just find me a nice quiet place to be. And I was crying my eyes out. And he believed me, fortunately. Supposing he hadn't. There's a very interesting book called God Gets in the Way of a Sailor, which you might like to read, which is about a sailor in the American Navy who had one of these experiences and rushed off to tell his Catholic priest very, very fast about it, and the priest said, ah, oh, yes, I see. And as he left the church, he found the van from the mental institution outside and two white-coated gentlemen who carted him straight off. Now, some 5 years later, they let him out. And the reason they let him out was very interesting. They discovered that all the patients in the ward seemed to like sitting and talking to him, and they were all getting better. And that's a true story, and you want to read the book, it's well worth reading. Yes, go ahead.
So that maybe under certain stressful circumstances, people that don't meditate can have kenshos, or perhaps drug-induced, or...
Drug-induced kenshos won't last.
Excuse me?
Drug-induced kenshos will not last. And what they will do is they will cause you to rob yourself. Because they will give you fragments of things. And when an actual kensho takes place, you won't know whether it's the real thing or something that you've got as a result of frying your brain. I have had two people in Shasta who have had Kensho experience, who had had drug experience beforehand, and they did not get something nearly as deep or as free because of that. That was the karmic consequence.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that people do that. I was
no, I know.
If that might not be a real good thing for mental institutions and doctors and so forth to know about that.
They do know about that, or I think
people.
They do. Yes.
Well,
there is a very good book written on this subject. I don't know if we've got it up here.
The Lee Sinella book.
Dr. Sinella. It's called, what is it?
Kundalini.
Kundalini is a lousy name for it. It really should be Enlightenment or Psychosis, and How to Tell Which is Which. Because gradually psychologists are beginning to realize that not everyone who is in mental institutions should really be there. There are a lot of things we don't understand. And you see, supposing you've got someone who is going through some of this lower section that's on the board, supposing you've got somebody who's having a really rough time going through all this stuff and cleaning it out, who suddenly grabs you around the neck and says, look, I've done such evil things in my lifetime, you've really got to hear what I've done. Because he really wants to tell someone about it, and you don't understand what is happening. You have some very serious situations on your hands. Very occasionally this happens. As a priest, you will have someone come in and say, look, I want to tell you what I've done. I really feel something ought to be done about it. I committed a crime or did something of this sort when I was very young. There is a very interesting book on the way in which the true Zen master handles it if the person is genuinely contrite and having a kendo. How many of you have read Beyond the Pale of Vengeance? Yeah. He comes to the Zen master having been a thief and a murderer for years and says, I just can't do this any longer. Help me. And the Zen master says, well, we could take you to the police and then you would be executed, or you could expiate what you have done. This is a story that goes back several centuries. And the man finds a place where there is a mountain and a torrent coming down the mountain, and thousands of travelers are killed every year trying to get around this particular area. And he settles down alone. He says, all right, my expiation will be to dig a track, a tunnel, through this area of the mountain, and I will do it alone. And years upon years, he gets to about the age of 80, and he thinks in the end he gets to the state when he doesn't believe he'll ever make it all the way through. And just as he's about to make it through the tunnel, although to the end of the mountain, although he doesn't know it, the son of one of the people who he murdered turns up to get vengeance on him, to take vengeance. And the man says, well, look, let me finish my tunnel first and then you may kill me. I don't think I've got much further to go. And the son settles down and glowers, and then he thinks, well, I'll be able to kill him the faster if I help him. So the two of them get working on the tunnel. And very soon it's done. And the old man says to him, right, go ahead and kill me now, because that is the karmic consequence. And the young man has been converted and become his disciple. It's an exquisite story of a much better method of dealing with the wrongdoers who are truly repentant. What do you do if you have a wrongdoer in Zen who really is rather proud of himself? I tell you what I did and what several other monks did. We called up the police. We had one person visit the priory who said, I've just assaulted a woman and I've left her for dead, and this is the second one I've done it with, and you can't do anything because you're a priest. And we said, oh no. And we called out the police, and he was collected up and taken to Vacaville. If one is proud of one's acts, it's one thing. If one is really repentant, it is quite another. Yes?
A little added note to that story. I remember the monk saying that the judge was quite impressed that the priest did stand up and
yes. And there's no way he could not have done, because supposing he'd said, oh, well, I mustn't do this, because that's what priests do, then a woman would have died in the gutter. As it was, she was taken to hospital and got better. And you see, supposing he'd let that happen, then the man would have been up for murder instead of merely assault. You've got to look at the chain and how the chain runs. You cannot run away from karma. You cannot run away from doing your duty because, oh, well, that's what a priest does and I've got to keep an image or I've got to do something that makes people believe in me. You have to take responsibility and go with responsibility. Yeah?
I came up with several questions during the reading.
Yeah.
One of them was, are the faults that I observe in myself and I am striving to overcome, are those karmic jangles?
Yes. 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 But above all, if you feel sort of this sort of being pressed or as though you're sitting on needles and the like, do use some of the mudras on yourself. Because, yes, it will bring the thing up faster. It'll also do something else. It'll release the tensions in those areas. One of the reasons that Zen masters live so long is that they have very, very little tension. And it's because they know how to do this.
In your hells, in your various hells, where is scatteredness gone?
Scatteredness? Oh, that you're sort of, that's what causes the meandering line in the middle, the sort of lows and highs in the sort of generally accepted amount of idiocy that it comes from not being fully aware, sort of being partially there. I'm sure you've bumped into people who are only partially with you. It might be good if on your meditation, if you find that you are scattered an awful lot, to use the method of counting breaths. That helps scatteredness quite a bit. But don't do it longer than you have to. Yes, there are some other pieces that you should at least look at, even if you don't have time to read. And that's plates 6, 20, 4, and 50 in the Lotus Blossom, which explain the advisability of not being willing to stay in heaven. Everybody knows it's unwise to stay in hell. Whatever you do, understand the importance of leaving heaven. Yeah.
Now, further, if a woman cannot have children,
mm-hmm.
I was confused on the position within the book on sex intercourse if you cannot procreate children.
There is nothing wrong with people procreating children. There will always be people who will procreate children.
No, I said nothing. I had, my question deals not with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's if she cannot have children.
Yes.
The book seemed to say that you should have intercourse to make children.
Yes.
Now, if you cannot have children,
then there is no point in having intercourse.
That's what the book said.
Yeah, there's just no point. You know the reason why? It depends what you're trying to do. If you really want to study and train in Buddhism, what you were saying is, I wish to return to the cosmic Buddha. I wish to become one with him. Now, if you wish to become one with the cosmic Buddha, you do not wish to become one with a husband or a wife. So, if what you want to do is become one with a husband or a wife and have children, that is fine. But if you are just doing it for amusement, that is external amusement. It is not something that makes you become one with the cosmic Buddha. It is like eating a meal without anything on the plate. Well, if you have no intention of becoming a monk, first of all, why would you study Buddhism, whether a layman ought to become a monk or to be a layman? Why would you study it if you did not wish to keep its precepts? No, I'm asking the same thing. You asked a question: if a person cannot have children. And I'm saying, why would a person study Buddhism if they did not wish to keep its precepts?
To enrich one's...
Yeah, you see, the whole thing comes out of what does the person want out of it? Mm-hmm. Do they want to become one with the cosmic Buddha? Or are they doing it if it's to enrich themselves? Or if it's to be as an actual study? Or to gain credit? Or, that was the question I was asking. It depends what you want out of it. If you want the highest form, and I always presume that people want the highest form, then they are going to have to give absolutely everything to get the highest form. If they are happy to settle for something less, that is fine. Maybe that is how much training they want to do in this particular lifetime. If they wish to do it to enrich themselves, that is fine. But they will not get the highest understanding. Does that answer your question? Yep.
Along that line, what if one partner became interested in Buddhism and really wanted to go to the cosmic Buddha and forego sex?
That is the bane of every Zen master's existence.
I asked
the wrong question. Brother, is that a problem? You almost make me want to climb a tree when you
I'm
ask.
I'm sorry.
No, because truthfully, the one thing you do not want to do is hurt a marriage. And you know that if a person has got to, I want the cosmic Buddha gleam in his eye, the marriage is doomed. It's absolutely doomed.
Then is it justified to divorce?
Well, I try to keep out of that as much as possible. But if he wants to go the whole way, there is no way the marriage can stay. What I would try and do is work on the conversion of the other partner between you and the game post. That's the only real way I can see it go. If you want to go the whole way, but if you want to live as a good lay Buddhist couple, then the problems are quite different. It depends how much you want out of it. You see, you can meet the cosmic Buddha, you can know the cosmic Buddha, as a layman who is married.
If the person said, well, yes, I want the cosmic Buddha, so I will divorce, but that is creating karma too, isn't it? If they have hurt that person by
leaving
them.
And they're going to have to put up with that karma, and they're going to have to clean it up.
So they'll say, okay, I'll accept the consequences of this, because I want this other so much. Is that
it's
work?
Usually not that nice and clean.
Oh.
One wishes that it was, but it never is. No, that is really the terror of every Zen monk. One partner wanting and the other not. I've had two or three in that situation. And usually I have not recommended that they divorce at all. I've suggested they both come. And let one sort of wander around and see if they like the idea, and the other one do some training. Maybe after he or she has done some training, they won't want to go on with it, and maybe after the other one's seen what it like, they would like to do so. We had one occasion where that happened, where one priest turned up, and, the husband and wife, one wanted badly to be a monk, and the other really wasn't interested. And within 3 years, the thing had switched over. They divorced, the other one left, and the other one stayed. There's no way you can really say, you see, at the beginning of a thing like that. That's the real headache. A person could divorce and then discover that he'd done the wrong thing. That's the terror of Zen masters, yes.
What if they both feel that way, and they want to be married, but they don't want to have sex together?
The cosmic Buddha, if you want to go to the cosmic Buddha, you're virtually making a contract with the cosmic Buddha. All right? You're saying, I want you. Now, when two people get married, what do they say? They make a contract saying, I want you. Which do you want? Can't have two pulls on it. And as you'll discover when we do get further on in these lectures, the spiritual marriage spoken of by St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross is identical to what happens to someone in a third gantra. That being so, since it is indeed a spiritual marriage, how can there be any form of marriage between that person and a husband or a wife? That is the marriage that takes place at death anyway. But if you want it in this life, then you can't have something else, because you can't be married to two at
one go. The cosmic Buddha will never play gooseberry to somebody else. And no, neither he shouldn't. He doesn't need to. You'll find when we go into it, you'll discover that the similarities are so great, it's incredible. I am in the midst of correspondence with a couple of Cistercian, fairly high up Cistercian monks on the subject, and it is fascinating what they're finding out. So you can't have it both ways, is what it comes down to. But you can have a first Kensho, and you can have a second to a certain extent. And have your third one when you die. You just can't have it now. Yes, anybody else? Yes. One goes into meditation in order to find one's true nature, which is the cosmic Buddha.
Then if I consider a question or something in a quieter state, I am not in meditation.
You may or may not be. It depends if it disturbs you. If it disturbs you, you are not in meditation. If it does not disturb you, it does not disturb the meditation. In the end, you have to answer all questions from a state of meditation. And then, no matter what they are like, if they create a disturbance, you are not meditating. Yeah.
You say that in the two books, the Avila and St. John, that they, the marriage, I haven't read them, but anyway, that was a third Kensho.
Yes.
Did they arrive at that then through the love of a personal savior, didn't they?
They both keep their mouths shut uncommonly well, and I don't blame them considering the periods in which they lived. If you read between the lines, they are bending over backwards to try and make the scriptures fit what they are talking about. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame them. There was an inquisition on at the time. Julian of Norwich does the same thing. One of you, I think it was you, asked me about the circulation of the light, which is the Taoist form of the spiritual marriage. And one of these, probably the last week or the week before last, we shall be going into this in great detail and comparing all the different versions throughout the different religions of how it is done and what the effects are like. I personally think that they knew all the scriptures, all the Christian scriptures, and after it had happened, it was so unlike anything they expected, they then had to find how the scriptures fitted to it. And this is also true of Zen and of anybody else. The thing is so unexpected, it is so not what you expected it to be, that you then have to settle down and say, well, how did that... Oh, I see how they got to this. I think it is easier to see in Zen and even in Taoism than it is in Christianity. It's there all right in Christianity. It's just got rather covered up. And I think it got covered up because people were afraid. You know what we've done in the West? We like to hang people and tear people up and kill people in every way under the sun we can think of, including burning at the stake. And with reason, people kept quiet or veiled what they were saying. And I don't see that as unreasonable. I see that staying alive safely. But it's just the same thing if you start studying it carefully. It's just that the East hasn't had to hide it so much. And yet in other ways, it's hidden it more. It's very odd to watch what has happened over the centuries, if you read the history of it. Christianity certainly had it right out in the open up until the 3rd century and started sort of hiding it towards the end of the 9th. And then it disappeared for a time. But it was still there, it was just all carefully hidden. I was going to do another course in that at a later date, the
Terry Young was thinking of having it with Christian and Jewish and other people lecturing in it as well, which I think would be good. Because the more we discover that what we're talking about is identically the same thing, but different ways of doing it, the happier we're going to be. It's really just looking in a window, and every one of us sees the same room. We're just looking in, as I said, different windows and going in via different doors. But if all you do is worry about how the door is decorated, you're never going to get inside. Don't worry about who opens the door. That's the other problem. Just go in.